This is a summary of A Promised Land by BestBookBriefings.com. A Promised Land by Barack Obama. Part 1, The Bet. Barack Obama had a strange heritage. From an estranged father in Kenya, to a mother from Kansas who spent most of her life in Indonesia, to Midwestern grandparents who lived in Hawaii. He was aware at a young age of all the different directions in which he was being pulled of race, and class, and nationality. While he believed in the ideal of America as a land of the free, growing up in Indonesia he met plenty of people who saw America the conqueror, America the exploitative. He found refuge from this conflict in books. As a child, he didn't know what he'd do with all the knowledge. But he felt sure that it would prove useful once he'd figured out his calling. This intellectual curiosity brought Bart to college with a smattering of political knowledge and a series of half-formed opinions. A worldview was beginning to form in his mind, the start of a political awakening. He was influenced by students who came from all sorts of places, with their own views and ideals that were rooted in the struggles in their communities. He was also inspired by early labor organizers and young leaders of the civil rights movement. Soon after, Bartsk moved to Chicago and got involved in community organizing and bringing ordinary people together to solve local issues. The victories were often small, and so was his personal impact on the city. But it had a big effect on him. Being able to work on the field made it so Obama had to listen and interact with people, instead of just theorizing about what they needed. He experienced failure, rejection, and insults, and learned to buck up and not fear them. But still, there were limits to what community work could accomplish. Bartsk saw that the power needed to change things on a larger, more structural level could be found in a higher office. This realization was partly spurred on by a man named Harold Washington. 2 years before Barack's arrival in Chicago, the city had elected Harold as its first black mayor. A small group of black activists and businessmen were tired of the city's unfairness towards them, so they banded together and inspired a wave of other disenfranchised citizens to register and vote. Upon his election, the city council separated into different tribes, with a majority that sought to oppose every change Harold tried to enact. Shortly after, he died of a heart attack, and things returned to the status quo. Despite this, Bartsk saw the effect Harold had had on the city, and the hope he gave its people that change could happen. This is what inspired him to run for public office. In Barack's first campaign to run as state senator of Springfield, Illinois, he learned from petitioning to respect the mechanics of politics, the daily grind, and the attention to detail that was necessary to win. Once he was elected, he learned that making a difference was difficult. Politicians in Springfield treated their job as a market that bought and sold favors, with the knowledge that most of their voters didn't really care what they did. But at the core of Barack's ideals was the concept that politics didn't have to be just what people thought it was, it could be something more. After a failed campaign to enter Congress, Bartsk scaled back for 2 years and started considering a life outside of politics. But still, he couldn't shake the desire to build a politics that could bridge America's various divisions, racial, political, economical. For that, he needed to work at a more structural level. He needed to speak to and for as wide an audience as he could get, to shake things up. He needed to run for the U.S. Senate. After losing to Bobby Rush for Congress, Bartsk understood what he needed to do to improve in his first candidate forum. He was too stiff and wordy, unable to deliver the neat phrases sound bites voters needed to understand points. He needed his campaign to be less about policies and papers, and more about connecting with voters on a personal level. Bartsk always has people come up to him and say that they knew he was meant to be president. He never put much stock by destiny himself in his opinion. Accidents and coincidences have more control over our lives than we think they do. And that God's plan is too big to account for any of our individual experiences. The best anyone can do is try to do what they feel is right and play the hand they are dealt. That said, by early 2006, it seemed at least possible that he could run for president. Plenty of other people certainly seemed to think so, from Harry Reid to Chuck Schumer to Dick Durbin. Bartsk heard the same message. Now more than ever, the country was desperate for a new voice. If nothing else, him running might help open up possibilities for Democrats down the line. Ted Kennedy, a living political legend in Washington, told him this: "The power to inspire is rare. You might think you aren't ready, but you don't choose the time, time chooses you. You either seize what could be your only chance, or you decide you can live knowing it's passed you by." Bartsk also knew that the day he took the oath to be president, the world would start seeing America differently. Kids all over the country of different colors and heritages would see themselves differently too. Horizons would be expanded. Possibilities would be opened. That alone would be worth the effort. It also meant something personal to him. If he won, it meant that the America he believed in was possible, a country where everything was possible. He had to stick with the bet. Part 2, Yes We Can. Bartsk was by nature a deliberate speaker. This helped to curb his mistakes as a presidential candidate, but his wordiness became a liability when it dragged out his answers, making it hard for people to listen. In words of his chief political consultant David Axelrod, or Ax, he'd get an A on the quiz, but win no votes. Ax criticized his approach to debates. "Your problem is that you keep trying to answer the question. That isn't the point. The point is to get your values across. Take whatever you're given and use it to talk about what you want to talk about." While frustrating, these issues were something Obama worked to improve as the campaign progressed. As the crowds became more manageable, he got to meet voters on a one-to-one basis and really listen to their struggles. These stories informed his speeches, made them less abstract and intellectual and more from the heart. People responded well because they saw their own lives reflected in the stories. Bartsk learned from working with his campaigners that a campaign, and democracy as a whole, was more of a chorus than a solo act. It was from this learning that he found one of his most important quotes. "When we've been told that we shouldn't try, Americans have a simple response, one that sums up their spirit: Yes, we can." It would become the slogan for his bid for presidency. Of course, the campaign was not all smooth sailing. His team experienced a decisive loss in New Hampshire, but instead of seeing it as a setback, it showed Obama and his team a winning quality about himself. He was at his calmest in the middle of a crisis. When asked, Bartsk could trace this trait back to many factors: his natural temperament or upbringing, and how he's trained himself to see the bigger picture and focus on his goals instead of the daily ups and downs. But Bartsk also drew on a lot of inspiration from his late grandmother, a child of the Depression who took up a banking job to support her family. "Sometimes, you just do what needs to be done," she would say. She taught him the value of working hard and doing your best, even if you didn't like the work. She taught him to combine passion with reason, not getting too excited when things were going well, and not to be too down when things went wrong. Another voice that helped Bartsk with his doubts was Otis Moss, pastor and civil rights veteran. "Those of us who were part of the movement, like Martin Luther King, we are the Moses generation. We got us out of Egypt, in a manner of speaking." Bartsk, You are part of the Joshua generation, and people like you are responsible for the next part of the journey. It will be up to you, with God's help, to build on what we've done and lead us out of the wilderness. In other words, what Obama was trying to do wasn't just out of ambition, but part of a chain of progress of other black leaders. Later, once Bartsk had won the position of the Democratic candidate, he decided that he needed to take 9 days to travel abroad, meeting with various world leaders. This was because he knew he needed to prove to Americans that he could operate not only domestically, but also on the international stage. To do this, he needed to gather as much information and field experience as he could. Part 3, Renegade. When Obama was elected as the 44th President of the United States, he knew that the first order of business was to pick the people to serve under him. Managers, facilitators, analysts, and problem solvers, all people he would need to depend on in order to set a direction for his country. It was exceedingly important that he choose the right people. Choices in people would reflect choices in policy, and each appointment showed his true political intentions. In the face of the looming economic crisis, Obama decided on experienced people for his economic team, people who had managed previous disasters, even if it meant that they might not be infallible or completely clean of mistakes from the past. Right off the bat, Obama and his team faced a tremendous issue. How were they going to stop the economy from collapsing? They developed a strategy that involved a government-funded fiscal stimulus. From an individual's perspective, it was wise to be thrifty during a recession. But if everyone stopped spending, things wouldn't improve. As such, a stimulus was needed, injecting money into the economy to keep it going until people were confident enough to spend again. Then it could work by itself once more. The question then was where and how the money was going to be spent. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act proposed that almost $800 billion would be divided into three roughly equal portions, one for unemployment insurance and direct aid, another for tax cuts for the middle class, and to encourage businesses to invest in new equipment now. The third portion was delegated to big, long-term initiatives that would put people to work while improving America road construction, solar and wind power, and incentives to reform education systems. To get this act through, Bartsk was going to have to deal with Congress. 60 votes in the Senate were needed to pass any legislation, as any fewer would give the opportunity for the opposition to launch a filibuster, talking endlessly in order to keep the floor occupied, thus preventing a vote from being called. While the Democratic had the majority during Obama's administration, the Republican Party had dug their heels in and decided to oppose any and all motions that Obama tried to pass. In fact, the Recovery Act passed with zero Republican votes. This refusal to work with Obama would prove to be a long-standing headache for him, as it meant that even the slightest waiver from the support of the Democrats on any bill could mean trashing it entirely. Support and confidence from the public was also a crucial factor. When Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner delivered his first public address, his speech was a disaster. While he was good at the financial part of his job, his presentation left something to be desired. As a result, the stock market dropped by almost 5% in a single day. Although Tim blamed himself, Bartsk realized that the failure was on him, since he hadn't prepared him. Learning from this mistake, he would drive his team to run a tighter ship to anticipate problems with their plans before they showed them to the public, to pay attention to the staffing of big projects, and to be careful not only with the substance of their plans, but the presentation too. Obama also made a point of meeting with each member of his cabinet to go over their plans for their departments. He pushed them to identify potential problems and to set priorities. He visited their agencies and spoke to the staffers, making sure to thank them for their service and remind them of how important their jobs were. Bartsk learned that no problem that made its way to him had a clean and perfect solution. Otherwise, someone lower down the chain would have dealt with it already. Instead, he had to face probabilities a 70% chance that doing nothing might be disastrous, a 55% chance that a different approach might be the solution, with a 30% chance that it might make it worse. Chasing after a 100% solution would be paralyzing, but going with your gut often meant letting your own preferences or biases guide a decision. As such, it was important that Obama establish a sound process, one where he could let go of his ego and listen to facts and experts on his team as best as he could. This meant he could make tough decisions and sleep easy, knowing he'd done the best he could. It also meant that the members of his team felt an ownership and responsibility over their decisions, which meant better execution and less grumbling. Part 4. The good fight. For Obama's first G20 summit, he stayed in his seat and listened carefully to every speaker. He knew that he was the kid on the block, and that other leaders in the room were paying attention to how he behaved. He figured being a little humble might help him work better with them. As commander-in-chief, Bartsk had the ability to order troops in the name of national security. He took no pleasure in this. He'd entered politics to help people, not kill them. Still, it was necessary work. The way he was it, his job was to fix certain aspects of the counterterrorism effort, not tear it all out and start over. One of the first things he did was to close Gitmo, the military prison at Guantanamo Bay. He also appointed John Brennan as Deputy National Security Advisor. Sure, he was a man who could make sure the needed changes in the system would happen. The biggest initiative of Obama's campaign were the reforms to health care. He knew that both the politics and substance of it were incredibly complicated, so it was his job to make sure that the process of legislating it was both transparent to the public and easy to understand. Another priority was finding the best health care team to head the process. For this, they recruited Kathleen Sebelius, a former insurance commissioner, Jean Lambreau, an expert on Medicare, and Nancy Andaparo, the Medicare administrator for the Clinton administration, and someone to whom the initiative was as personally important as it was for Bartsk. Every job comes with surprises. Even the best organizations can't prepare for everything, so it's important to learn how to improvise or learn to cut your losses. In the presidency, the surprises came every day. While his team dealt with the financial crisis, the wars, and the healthcare reform, the H1N1 flu outbreak happened. Previous staffers advised Obama that he needed to be involved, but he also needed to let the experts run things. A good thing then, that he had already appointed three. As a result, without much fuss, the virus was contained with the minimum casualty. Bartsk realized that sometimes the most important work was in the things no one noticed. Part 5. The world as it is. Obama saw military action as a tool of last resort. To be secure, America needed to strengthen its alliances and international connections. Managing the wars they were in was important, but he wanted to put diplomacy to the test. Every foreign policy statement emphasized international cooperation and America's desire to engage other nations with mutual interest and respect. If we want other countries to support us, Obama told his team, we can't bully them. We need to show that we respect their perspectives. 2. Bartsk made a point of being interested in the history and culture of the places he visited. He tried to get out and see the sights of each country. 2. He knew that his interest in local attractions would make a more lasting impression on the average foreign citizen than any meeting or press conference. It also gave him a chance to interact a little with ordinary people, instead of just government officials and elites. Obama's most effective diplomatic strategy came from the town hall meetings he had with young people. Seeing a head of state making himself directly accessible to citizens was a meaningful argument for democracy. It also gave the marginalized who came to speak with him a platform to be heard. Still, there were limits to what that could achieve. At the end of the day, nations were driven by their own interests, as well as the ones of those who had power and wanted to maintain. Foreign leaders were rarely influenced by morality alone, especially those who ran repressive governments. As such, a harder diplomacy was needed, one of concrete rewards and punishments. In cases where world leaders employed violence to maintain control, the pressure mounted on Obama to act. However, he learned a difficult lesson about being president. His decisions were now chained to strategy and tactics for what was best for the country. As the most powerful man on earth, he had less freedom to say what he meant and act on it than an ordinary citizen did. Being president meant having to change your expectations when it comes to time. Your efforts will rarely bear fruit right away. The things you deal with are on too big of a scale, too complicated to be solved easily and quickly. You learn to judge your progress in slower and smaller steps, understanding that your goals might take years to be achieved, if at all, and even then, they might go totally unappreciated by the public. Take, for example, the ever-looming reality of climate change. People usually concern themselves with their own material needs first. The change that a government might enact requires putting in place inconvenient and expensive policies now, in order to prevent a crisis in the future. Changes were being made, from citizens to companies, but they all faced the same problem no matter how advanced the technology was. They still had to work in an economy that was still built around oil, gas, and coal. This is where Obama hoped that the Recovery Act could come in, using $90 billion of the available stimulus to fund clean energy initiatives in America. Some investments didn't quite pan out. Of course, a solar panel company received a $535 million loan, but would go bankrupt in 2011. It was a PR nightmare, but Barrett tried to take it in his stride. Nothing ever worked exactly as planned. After all, getting things done as the president meant opening himself to criticism, being mediocre, and playing it safe would only betray the hopes of those who voted for him. Part 6. In the Barrel. During stressful times, Barrett took it upon himself to keep up morale with his staff. He was generous with his praise and measured with his criticisms. During meetings, he made a point of asking what everyone thought, even the junior staffers. Small things mattered, like bringing out the cake for someone's birthday himself. When he had the time, he'd walk around the West Wing, asking how people were doing and what he could be doing better. He also learned that he needed to pay more attention to the experiences of the women and people of color on his staff. When friction arose from having stressed-out achievers in a room, men would often take a more assertive stance, and women would withdraw and stop talking. Obama met up with some of the more senior women members of his staff and did his best to learn and listen. Personally, Barrett was mostly shaken by the stress of his job. As he'd learned from his campaign, struggles and obstacles rarely shook him. The trouble was when he felt useless, like he was wasting his time and opportunities. Even during his worst days as the president, he never felt that way. He could have done without all the fuss of being president, but he loved the work itself. That said, He tried to keep a healthy schedule and work-life balance during his term. He made sure to spend time every day with his family and maintain his rituals of taking walks and working out in the morning. An article called The Runaway General was published, where Stanley McChrystal, the commander of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, was quoted mocking, among others, Vice President Joe Biden and diplomat Richard Holbrooke. At first, Obama had considered letting McChrystal off with a sternly worded reprimand. After all, Obama and his own senior staff had private conversations that wouldn't have looked good in the media either. At one point or another, everyone in the White House had said something on tape that they shouldn't have. However, Bartz determined that McChrystal was a different case. The armed forces of America depended on discipline and set codes of conduct. Any captain who spoke badly of their superior officer would be punished accordingly, much less a four-star general like McChrystal. There was also the fact that ever since the Bush years, some of those in the military were starting to take the view when it came to war. Politicians shouldn't just give them what they asked for and stay out of the way. It was a threat to a principle of democracy, and Obama could not let it stand. Shortly after, McChrystal quietly apologized and resigned. Part 7, On the High Wire. Sometimes, Bartz wondered how much an individual leader's characteristics mattered to the course of history, if his hopes and insecurities, his childhood traumas and hopes, carried the same weight as a shift in technology or a trend in the economy. Are those who rise to power just an expression of the currents of the times, or do they have some control over the future? Netanyahu and Abbas were leaders of the opposing sides of the Middle East conflict, Israel and Palestine. On behalf of America, Obama had both the influence and the responsibility to facilitate negotiations between them. He rallied on a group of talented diplomats, like Hillary Clinton and George Mitchell, but the resulting meetings were too polite, too noncommittal. Nothing really came of it. When it came to conflicts like these, there was always internal and external pressure on Obama to take a side, to use America's power to influence the situation. In his words, however, the U.S. is an ocean liner, not a speedboat. If we want to change our approach, we need a strategy that builds over time. Even so, situations in the Middle East quickly escalated in Egypt. People were protesting Hosni Mubarak's position as the president and calling for him to step down. In response, Mubarak started clamping down on his citizens, using the military and the police force to violently suppress them. No matter how much pressure was placed on him, he would not step down. Obama had to take a stand. He might not be able to stop China or Russia, but Mubarak's regime had been funded by billions of American dollars, supplying them with weapons and training their military. They had called him an ally, but now that he was raining down violence on peaceful protests, he had to call for Mubarak to step down. To do otherwise would do too much damage to America's ideals and to Bartz. The height of Obama's military engagement in the Middle East was the raid on the Abbottabad compound and the subsequent elimination of Osama bin Laden. On the night he made the decision to order the raid, he had a clear mind on the stakes and risks involved. While he had supreme confidence in the SEAL team and had quietly worked the odds of success, he knew that the outcome wouldn't be guaranteed. Still, he was fully prepared and fully confident in calling the shot. Apart from a couple of setbacks, the mission went smoothly, eliminating the terrorist America had sworn to enact justice upon, all the way back from the Bush administration. While it wouldn't be the end of their troubles, Obama hoped it would help America refocus on who the real enemy had been: a group of deranged killers, not a country, a religion, or an ideal. Still, he couldn't celebrate wholeheartedly. This would be the only endeavor of his campaign that the entire country came together to support. Democrats and Republicans all. Was that unity only possible when the goal was to kill a terrorist? If only the same persistence could be applied to reducing poverty or pollution, or making sure every family had access to good daycare. Some might have called it utopian, but Obama only took it as a measure of how much work was still left to do the president still had to do for his country. Barrett's Kate Obama is the 44th president of the United States. Born in Honolulu, Hawaii, he first worked as a community organizer in Chicago, then as a civil rights attorney, then as the representative of the 13th District of Illinois, and then as a U.S. Senator. He is the winner of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize and the author of four books, Dreams from My Father, The Audacity of Hope, Of the Icing, and A Promised Land. He and his wife Michelle are the proud parents of Malia and Sasha. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.